Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark, Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.
Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. pledged to release the causes of autism this month. Our guest Jessica Steyer just wrote a New York Times article about one of the most damaging myths in public health. She's here to talk about how vaccines do not cause autism and why this fake news keeps being spread. Welcome to Care Talk Live, where we talk about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America and get you answers. I'm Laura Packard, cancer survivor and healthcare advocate, here to help you. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-6837, and our experts will answer them in future episodes. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts to get next week's Care Talk show. In today's episode, Dr. Steyer, a public health scientist who specializes in science communication, talks about the sophisticated tactics being used to manufacture a vaccine autism link and dismantle America's vaccination infrastructure. So welcome, Jess Steyer, the co-founder and CEO of the Unbiased Science Podcast. She's also executive director of the Science Literacy Lab. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with, what is unbiased science? Tell us about what you do and how you got started.
Sure. So I'm a public health scientist. My background is really in the use of data to evaluate health programs and policies. I was doing a lot of CMS, Medicaid waiver evaluations, that type of stuff. And then early in the pandemic, was receiving a lot of questions from people who were like, Jess has a degree in public health. This seems relevant to what's going on in the pandemic, especially once the COVID vaccines were developed. And so I started answering questions informally, mainly for my mom and her friends. And, you know, it grew. I started getting requests from people who I wasn't friends with. And I was like, you know what? I should create a space where people can ask questions and get the best available evidence. And that's how Unbiased Science was born. And now we tackle a variety of topics. We've been doing it for the last 5 years. We do infographics on social media. We have a podcast. We do long form content. And we try, as cliche as it might sound, to meet people where they are and to answer questions with the best available evidence.
So let's start with the big one. Do vaccines cause autism?
No, there is no robust, good evidence at all of any link whatsoever between any type of vaccine and autism in anyone. So happy to elaborate.
Yes. Why do people think this? You know, because this has been something that's been circulating, people have been talking about, thinking about for many years now. Where did it come from?
Yeah, so it all started back in 1998, where this British doctor named Andrew Wakefield put out a study, and I use the term very loosely for reasons that I'll explain in a moment. It was retracted. It was found to be built on falsified data. He was receiving, Wakefield was receiving funding from lawyers in lawsuits against vaccine manufacturers. He himself was developing a competing vaccine to the MMR vaccine, which is at the heart of this study that he conducted. I mean, there was nothing robust about this. It was the whole thing was rubbish. And so, as I said, it was retracted. He was actually barred from practicing medicine in Britain, but the impact of that quote unquote study has had long lasting effects for decades. It has been a myth that we just can't shake. We've seen vaccine rates. They actually started dropping shortly after that study came out in 1998. And so, yeah, it's a mess, but it's a myth that we cannot seem to shake.
So I can understand that people might have concerns, that, especially if it's their first child and they're not familiar with vaccines and their kids, and there's quite a list of vaccines that their kid needs to get. So how can we educate people on the importance of these vaccines when, again, if it's your first child and you don't have experience with having kids and vaccines, this can feel new and maybe scary, because as a first-time parent, you don't want to wreck your kid with all the things that you're doing for the first time.
Totally. And this really resonates with me. I'm a mom. I have two kids. And even as a public health scientist who has studied vaccine safety for decades, so sorry if you hear my dogs barking in the background. I'll tell you that when I saw the doctors approaching, do you want me to mute for a sec? Or is it okay? I'm so sorry. I'll just roll with it. I'm human, right? It's human. Thank you. We're just going to roll with it. And thank you. My kids are now screaming at the dogs. This is wonderful. Hang on one second. Okay, here we go. So I was going to say, even as someone who knows all about vaccine safety, seeing the doctors approach my own kids as babies with the shots, I mean, it's still like, oh, you know, am I doing the right thing? It's scary. And I totally understand that. But this is where scientific consensus is so important, and why it is important that we listen to experts. And the overwhelming medical consensus, every major professional medical and scientific organization saying that yes, vaccines, like every medical intervention, like all things in life, yes, they come with some risks, but my goodness, do the benefits far outweigh the risks. And I always say that public health is a victim of its own success. And I think that we don't see these things, these diseases. They seem like, why are we even taking these vaccines? These are not diseases that I'm hearing about, you know, and it's because the vaccines are so effective. And it's, you know, it's a real double-edged sword that the vaccines work so well.
I think you're exactly right that, you know, right now you're faced with your screaming baby, your screaming child, your barking dog, and the risks of these diseases may seem so far off or remote because nobody you know has had mumps or diphtheria. And I think you're exactly right about how, because we've had success with vaccination, most people do not get measles, most people do not get mumps, most people do not get polio, rubella, all of these things. But they are really bad things. And people need to keep in perspective how bad these diseases are if your child got them.
I could not agree with you more. And the other trap that I think people fall into, at least things that I've seen on social media, it's like, oh, well, so-and-so, and I'm making this up right now. My brain is not firing on all cylinders, but, you know, measles will only kill, I don't know, I'm making this up again, 1% of people who are infected with it, right? I think it's actually higher than that. But the point is that, first of all, death is not the only outcome of these diseases. There are so many other outcomes. It's not a binary, you live, you die. You could be hospitalized. You can get very sick. Things like measles, people don't realize, causes something called immune amnesia, which I don't know if you've heard of this. It's like, to me, the scariest thing. It basically, anyone who gets measles, even if you have a very mild case of measles, you have some level of this thing called immune amnesia, where your immune system literally forgets things that it's been trained to protect against, other than measles. We're not just talking about measles. We're talking about everything that your body has been exposed to, right? Because every time we get exposed to something, our immune system gets trained to protect against it. So there's immune amnesia, which leaves us super vulnerable to lots of other things. Then there's something, a certain type of encephalitis, which if you do develop it, it is fatal in, I believe, all cases, if I'm not mistaken, most, if not all cases. So, and even with COVID, we hear this all the time. Oh, the death rate is only X percent. Oh my goodness, how many people are suffering with long COVID or have been hospitalized or have had different, you know, organ systems impacted by this virus? If we have a tool that lessens the likelihood of those really terrible outcomes, and that tool, while not, you know, doesn't carry zero risk, but is really, really, really overwhelmingly safe, why are we not taking it? You know, it's very frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think what's interesting with long COVID, or and this is cutting edge science, it isn't even really all figured out yet, but it seems like viruses can trigger long lasting conditions. People who have had Lyme, people who have had other viruses. And I had a friend in college that had chronic fatigue syndrome, and it was rare, but some of these chronic illnesses are becoming more common. And it could be that viruses are triggering some of these things too.
I am so happy that you said that. Yes, absolutely. And it's always interesting to me that so much of the unfortunate, you know, misinformation and falsehoods on social media will focus on these side effects of the vaccines. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, the virus itself, as you said, and I am not an immunologist, but my understanding is that the virus can trigger, you know, latent autoimmune conditions, even take something like myocarditis, which we've heard so much about with regard to the COVID-19, the mRNA vaccines in particular for boys and young men. It is true that the vaccine, the COVID-19 mRNA vaccine can cause and has caused myocarditis, particularly among young boys and young men. But the cases of myocarditis are so much milder than the cases that are caused by the virus itself. Typically, so not only is it more likely that you'll get myocarditis after the virus than after the vaccine, cases are more severe. And so it's always interesting to me that we're talking, there's so much focus on the vaccine side effects, which are by and large exceedingly rare, and not, as you said, on these other impacts of the virus itself. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, one thing I've learned since COVID is that really you don't want to have a virus of any kind, because it may not be likely that it'll trigger a chronic condition, but you're rolling the dice. And it's back to the if 1% of people have any type of have severe or even death associated with any virus, you don't want to roll the dice with chronic conditions or anything else. It's better just not to get sick. And it's so much cheaper, even in our broken healthcare system, to get a vaccine than to deal with a hospitalization or lifelong effects or, you know, chronic conditions. Just even the financial costs of getting sick, it is so much cheaper to vaccinate.
1,000%. And I would just add or clarify, you know, that some vaccines, they're all different types of vaccines, right? And some vaccines do cause something called sterilizing immunity, which basically stops the virus, from us from even getting sick in the first place. And that's like amazing. And MMR is a great example of a vaccine that prevents us from even getting measles in the first place. But then you have other vaccines like the COVID vaccine, totally different technology. And the primary goal of that is not to stop us from getting infected. I know, you know, the large majority of us who have been vaccinated have had COVID, but it does prevent, as you said, hospitalization, severe illness, and of course, worst possible outcome of death. And all the costs associated with that, hospital stays, missing work, missing school, needing to coordinate childcare if your child is getting severely sick, all the things. So absolutely, it is far more complicated than that.
So let's talk about this myth of vaccines and autism. One of the reasons why this keeps coming back is that various people that are pushing this idea are financially benefiting in some way from these falsehoods, right? Can you talk about that?
Yes, and I'm so glad that you said this because, you know, we hear all the time about pharma influence and, you know, all of this idea that doctors and scientists are profiting wildly. By the way, vaccines make up such a tiny percentage of what pharma companies of their profits, and doctors are certainly not profiting off of, you know, having their patients vaccinated. But on the flip side, there are full-blown organizations that are profiting off of this misinformation, this idea that vaccines are bad for us or harming us or, you know, are causing outcomes, including autism, ADHD, asthma, all kinds of other issues. And so, yeah, I mean, it's maddening because people are getting very, very rich. And I don't think people, you know, I'll often hear, well, why are they doing that? Why are they pushing this idea? Because power, money, and influence, right? You know, there are full-blown organizations. People have made a lot of money off of this ideology.
So Diane has a question about who is getting paid. And one of the organizations that makes a lot of money off of vaccine information is RFK's former organization, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Children's Health Defense is one that stands out. I believe it was Stat News that reported that at one point he was making about $20,000 per week. I think he only was receiving that payment for a certain amount of time. I like to be super accurate. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head. I think the total was like just under $400,000 for just a couple of months of work. So there is a lot of money flow in terms of, you know, who's paying them. There are people who are very much organizations that, you know, people are paying into to propagate this information, and they're paying those who propagate the misinformation. So I don't know because I'm not super involved with those organizations, you know, on the specifics of who's paying what. But yeah, a lot of money being exchanged.
Well, and finally, for our audience, if people have questions or thoughts about anything medical and something that comes across TikTok or they see something on Instagram or whatever, what are the things people should be looking for to know whether the information is accurate or not and whether the source is biased or not?
A great question. I could talk about this for a really long time, but I'll give you some red flags maybe that stand out. So first of all, you have to listen to the overwhelming consensus. So I would look to major medical and scientific professional organizations, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. You know, they represent thousands of scientists and clinicians, right? Because you're always going to have some people here and there will have differences of opinion. That's just part of the scientific process. That's why consensus matters so much. So, you know, does whatever is being said go against the overwhelming consensus? Is whatever is being said based on a single study? Is it based on, you know, a preclinical study? I see a lot coming out on the harms of food dyes or food additives, but they'll look at, you know, one study that's conducted in rats. So yeah, unless you're a rat being submerged in a vat of red dye 30, you probably don't need to worry about, you know, about this causing cancer. What else? If you're reading something on social media that elicits a very strong emotional reaction, stop and think, why does this want me to have that reaction, right? Are they trying to get me to buy something or subscribe to something? Are they oversimplifying? Are they making things very black and white? This causes X outcome, or avoiding this, you will extend your life by X number of years. The reality is so much more nuanced. We always say science is gray. And this, frankly, is our biggest challenge up against the wellness influencers, because they're putting on a silver platter very easy, tangible solutions for people, right? They're giving people a sense of control. If you eat this, you will live longer. If you avoid this, you know, whatever it is, they're making it very actionable for people. And we in medicine and science, we have all of our caveats and, oh, well, yes, the risk might increase, but it's multifactorial, right? So that's a lot less sexy. Other red flags. I mean, the appeal to nature fallacy is a big thing I'm seeing very rampant, in particular among the MAHA movement, the Make America Healthy Again movement, this idea that anything synthetic or made in a lab is just, you know, inherently harmful, and that things that are natural are better for us. That is such an oversimplification. It sets up this false dichotomy that nature and science are separate when, of course, they're completely, you know, entangled, intertwined. So I hope that that's helpful. And certainly you want to look at sources, you know, are people providing actual sources to back up what they're saying? And again, not just one-off studies, because if you did a search and we could talk about it, like you can find a study. There are studies out there that will show a link between vaccines and autism, right? But it's the quality of evidence that the, you know, if I looked at that study, there are major methodological flaws, and that the overwhelming body of evidence points to there being no association. So that's why you don't want to look at these one-off things that could be very deceptive.
Mm-hmm. And I can understand why new parents especially are vulnerable, because they're questioning everything. They don't want to get it wrong with their kid. And as a cancer survivor, when I was diagnosed, I was reading everything. I was open to anything to not have cancer. So people who are in vulnerable positions, I think, are especially susceptible to medical and wellness misinformation, where people are telling you all kinds of things. In the end, they are trying to make money for themselves, and they could not care less about the health of you and your family.
You just nailed it. And that's what gets me the most. You know, it's so predatory, and they're really preying on people who are most vulnerable, who are looking for answers. Why did I get this diagnosis? Right. And then there's so much shame and blame that it's something that you did and you caused this, when the reality is that so much of our health, I mean, there's a, like I said, multifactorial. There are genetic components, environmental components. It's so complicated that, you know, it's so rare for us. Like the one example is, yes, we know that smoking obviously is very, very likely to increase your risk for lung cancer. But there's so few things that are so clear cut like that. And it just feels, it's so predatory. I hate that.
So where can people get unbiased science information?
Well, I don't know if you mean my information or unbiased science information in general. I mean, we're like I said, on all channels, and you could follow at Unbiased SciPod, and we're on Substack, and we're on all the places where you can consume information on social media. But there are so many of us doing really high quality science communication, you know, and we tend to share each other's work and really elevate, because we can't be expert in all things. Like I said, my background is in social science, data science. So I'm not a clinician. I'm not an expert in immunology. And so there are networks of us where we lift each other up. Children's Hospital of Philadelphia remains one of my favorite resources, in particular for parents. Like I said, major medical organizations, AAP, ACOG, they have fantastic resources. State departments of health or local departments of health often have great resources, especially tailored to the place where you live. So there are resources out there. It's just really tricky, because I get it. People are being inundated. There's a waterfall of information being hurled at us. And frankly, social media, you know, and our algorithms are not helping the situation. It really curates what we're exposed to. So I think that I mentioned a few sources. I hope that that's a helpful starting point.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. Thank you so much for having this conversation.
Thank you. And now our experts are going to answer your health insurance questions. So welcome to Diane Archer, the founder and president of Just Care USA and senior advisor on Medicare at Social Security Works, and Louise Norris, the health insurance and healthcare reform analyst at healthinsurance.org. So let's start with Louise, because CMS announced some catastrophic plan health insurance access. So there's some news on the health insurance front from CMS.
Yes. So catastrophic plans, this back in the old days, this used to sort of be a catch-all term for kind of really high deductible plans. Sometimes people would use that word to describe plans that just were bare bones coverage. But the Affordable Care Act made an actual definition for that. A catastrophic health plan It's fully ACA compliant, so it covers your pre-existing conditions, it covers all the essential health benefits, it provides free preventive care, just like any other health plan is required to. They're sold in the marketplace and also directly through insurance companies. They're only widely available to people under the age of 30. The way the rules have worked up till now, if you're over 30, you have to qualify for a hardship exemption in order to get a catastrophic plan. And those hardship exemptions have been kind of challenging to get. So very few people enroll in catastrophic plans. They do tend to be cheaper than bronze plans, but you can't use premium subsidies to buy them. So the only people who buy these plans are 20 somethings who don't qualify for marketplace subsidies. So this year, for example, during the last open enrollment period, 24 million people enrolled in marketplace plans, only 54,000 of them selected catastrophic plans. What CMS announced last week was they want to make it easier for people who are 30 and older to qualify for that hardship exemption to buy a catastrophic plan, because there's a lot of concern that health insurance in the marketplace is going to get much more expensive next year, because Congress, as of right now, is letting the subsidy enhancements that have been in place since 2021 expire at the end of this year. So what that means is starting in 2026, unless Congress decides to act before the end of the year, starting in 2026, people with income over 400% of the federal poverty level will lose their subsidies altogether. Doesn't matter how much their health insurance costs, they will be paying full price. So what CMS is doing is letting all of those folks qualify for a hardship exemption, and they're going to let them do the process online fairly automated, much easier than it has been up till now. So the idea is to make these plans, catastrophic plans that are cheaper, more readily available to folks who are going to have to pay full price for their coverage anyway. So that's the news that CMS announced last week that people can know for going into this upcoming open enrollment period.
Thanks. And so there's reasons why the catastrophic plans are cheaper, right? So people shouldn't, if you can afford a better plan, a catastrophic plan is maybe not the best choice.
So they're very similar to bronze plans in terms of the plan, the benefits. They do have very high deductibles. The deductible is set equal to the maximum out-of-pocket limit for the year, which for next year is $10,600. So both your deductible is the full out-of-pocket cost. Bronze plans, it's more likely you might see a bronze plan with like a $9,000 or $10,000 deductible and then a little bit of coinsurance on top. The catastrophic plan is just all deductible. Catastrophic plans do cover 3 primary care visits with copays before the deductible, which some bronze plans do that, some do not. So coverage-wise, the benefits are very similar to bronze plans. The reason they're less expensive is because when it comes to risk adjustment, which is how it's kind of a wonky way that these health plans protect against one plan sort of cherry-picking consumers who are healthier, plans that have healthier enrollees have to give money to the plans that have sicker enrollees. Catastrophic plans just do that with other catastrophic plans, whereas bronze plans do it with other metal level plans. So bronze plans are more expensive usually than catastrophic plans because of that, because those catastrophic plans tend to, like I said, be a bunch of healthy, affluent 20-somethings. So starting next year, there could be a lot more older folks who end up with those plans. If you are eligible for marketplace subsidies at all, and you pick a catastrophic plan, you forfeit your subsidy. So that is important to know. And you can't go back then and claim that subsidy on your tax return. If you enroll in a bronze plan or silver or gold, and then your income changes during the year and it turns out you were subsidy eligible, you can claim the full subsidy on your tax return. You can't do that if you picked a catastrophic plan. So it's really, there are definitely some things to keep in mind, but they are fully ACA compliant. The coverage, like I say, is going to be quite similar to what you'd get with a bronze plan. Just no subsidies, and that's the difference.
Thanks. And now from Diane, wanted to know, why can't people always rely on insurance agents to make a good Medicare Advantage plan choice? We were having quite a discussion earlier about health insurance agents and what the incentives are, whether your insurance agent is really going to offer you the best plans.
Yeah, I think that's the question that you can never know the answer to, but there's actually great information available about your choices between Medicare Advantage and traditional Medicare. So if you can afford traditional Medicare with supplemental coverage and a standalone prescription drug plan, that's always going to be your best option because it's going to cover your care from any doctor or hospital almost that you want to see anywhere in the country without the challenges of going through prior authorization. You're much more likely to get the care you need from the doctors and hospitals you know and trust in traditional Medicare. If you're going into Medicare Advantage, the choice is really, I say, a bit like a game of Russian roulette. It's a big gamble, and that's for two reasons. The first reason is that even though the insurers have plenty of information on each Medicare Advantage plan, they don't disclose the information that they're even legally obligated to disclose, let alone richer information. And so that the information just isn't there for people to know which plans to avoid. And what we do know is that the 5% of worst performing plans are responsible for tens of thousands of deaths a year, according to one major study, preventable deaths. So you want to avoid the bad actor plans and you can't. And you can't rely on an insurance agent to tell you which plans to avoid or which plans to choose because they don't have any information that anybody else doesn't have. There's just not the information available. So they can steer you, but they're most likely to steer you to the plans that the insurers who are hiring them want you to enroll in. And these sales agents usually get paid a very high commission to steer you to particular plans that are most likely to maximize profits for the insurance companies they work for, but may not meet your needs. So that's why I say, don't trust an insurance agent. There could be good ones, but don't think because they're kind and they smile a lot that they're going to actually steer you to what you need, because honestly, nobody knows what you need. And the insurance agents, as I've said, are financially incentivized to steer you to the plans that the insurance companies want you to enroll in. Now, with that, I will add that you can call your state health insurance assistance program for free help. Sometimes they're hard to reach. You can also call the Medicare Rights Center for free assistance at 1-800-333-4114. They have a team of volunteers who can help you provide unbiased guidance in choosing a Medicare Advantage plan if that's the direction you feel you need to go because you can't afford traditional Medicare. But keep in mind, as Louise was saying earlier, that if you do choose Medicare Advantage because you don't want to pay the upfront costs of traditional Medicare, the cost for the supplemental coverage and the cost for the prescription drug coverage, that you may end up being locked into your Medicare Advantage plan. And while you're healthy, the Medicare Advantage plan is going to feel like it's a pretty great deal because you're not paying any upfront dollars. But once you get sick and you face obstacles to seeing the doctors you need to see or getting the rehab services that you deeply need, you're going to find that it's going to be usually next to impossible to go back into traditional Medicare to get the care you need, unless you live in one of just a few states that give you access to Medicare supplemental coverage all the time. But federal law does not give that to you.
So a red flag would be if you're talking to an insurance agent and they don't talk about traditional Medicare, if they only give you Medicare Advantage plans and they don't show you all of your options, that would be a red flag.
It would be a red flag, but I would say don't talk to the insurance agents. Call your state health insurance assistance program for free, unbiased assistance, or the Medicare Rights Center. I think we all can get seduced by a really nice person who seems to be desiring to help you, and you don't want to be sucked into getting bad information.
And Louise was giving us an answer on the previous show about how advanced premium tax credits work. But to give a more complete answer, as her Wi-Fi permits this time, Louise, what are advanced premium tax credits and how do they work with the Affordable Care Act?
Sure. So, and the reason this is an issue right now is because, as I was talking about earlier, if the enhancements to these premium tax credits is allowed to expire, then the structure of these tax credits is really going to change for next year. So under the Affordable Care Act, they made individual market health insurance coverage much better and made it so that it would cover people with pre-existing conditions, cover all the essential health benefits. But the result of that was that the coverage became much more expensive. So to mitigate that, they added a federal subsidy that is income-based that makes the premiums affordable for people. Without these subsidies, purchasing health insurance on your own would be a non-starter for most people just because of the cost. So the vast majority of marketplace enrollees, like around 92-93%, are eligible for these tax credits. But unlike most tax credits that you just have to claim on your tax return, you get the marketplace tax credits upfront. So they don't send them to you, they send them to your insurance company. So you sign up for marketplace coverage, you project an income. You're doing this in advance, which does make it a little tricky. When you're signing up this fall for coverage effective in 2026, you're going to project what you think you will earn in 2026. And based on that amount, they will say, okay, you qualify for X amount of premium tax credit every month. And then they will send that money directly to your insurance company, and you only have to pay the difference then of what your plan costs minus that tax credit. So this keeps people's coverage much more affordable than it would otherwise be. Before 2021, the ACA cut off tax credits altogether if your income was more than 400% of the federal poverty level. So what that did is for some people, especially older people, like if you're in your late 50s, early 60s, and especially if you live in an area where health insurance is particularly expensive, you had what was called the subsidy cliff, which meant you went from, if you earned 399% of the poverty level, you were getting a huge subsidy credit or subsidy for your health insurance. And if you were at 401%, you get nothing. So back in 2021, the American Rescue Plan did away with that hard limit, and instead it just made it phased out gradually, so nobody had to pay more than 8.5% of their income for their health insurance, depending on what plan you buy. But so at higher incomes, especially for older people, especially in places where health insurance is really expensive, you could still be getting a tax credit and earning well over 400% of the poverty level. What they did is, since 2021, it's been on a sliding scale. You pay somewhere between 0% and 8.5% of your income for health insurance. Depending on what your income is, you're somewhere in that range, and keeps it affordable for everybody. If these subsidy enhancements expire at the end of this year, starting in 2026, we will go back to having that hard cap at 400% of the federal poverty level, which for one person next year, that'll be just under $63,000 for the year. For a family of four, it'll be just under $129,000 for the year. If you're over that limit, no subsidy at all. You pay full price. It will also change that range that I was talking about, 0 to 8.5%. It will bump it up to, it'll be ranging from 2.1% to almost 10% of household income that you have to pay for your health insurance. So even at the lower income ranges, everybody pays more under that system. So this is why it's so important. People are saying, you know, call your members of Congress to talk to them about how important it is to sort out a way to extend those subsidy enhancements, because if we don't, everyone who gets a marketplace subsidy is going to pay quite a bit more for their health insurance next year, and some folks are going to lose their subsidy altogether.
Thank you, Louise. And thank you, everyone, for joining us today to learn how to truly make America more healthy. Please text or call in your health insurance and healthcare questions at 202-838-8255. 6837 and we'll answer them in future episodes. Join us next week for more on healthcare in America. Be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Laura Packard, and this is Care Talk.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.